Today is Friday, June 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The man known as Zambia's founding father has died at the age of 97.
He led a massive civil disobedience campaign against the British colonial rule when Zambia was called Northern Rhodesia.
Plus, the United States has a new federal holiday marking the end of slavery.
But I think this will go down for me. One of the greatest honors I will have had as president.
We'll have these stories and more next. The man known as Zambia's founding father has passed away at the age of 97. Kenneth Kaunda rose to power during Africa's post-independence period when dozens of former European colonies gained their freedom. Africa 54's Paul Ndiho has this look back at his life.
Kenneth David Kaunda was born on April 28, 1924, the youngest of eight children. He served as Zambia's first president from 1964 to 1991. Early in life, President Kaunda was fascinated with the struggle for independence. He led a massive civil disobedience campaign against the British colonial rule when Zambia was called Northern Rhodesia. Battling tough odds, his ability to break away from the Northern Rhodesian African National Congress political party to form his political party, the United National Independence Political Party, did not come easy. After repeated hardships, he won the hearts and minds of ordinary Zambians to lead the Southern African nation to independence. Succumbing to international pressure, Kaunda was forced to change the rules that kept him in power. Multi-party elections took place in 1991, in which Frederick Chiluba, the leader of the movement for multi-party democracy, ousted Kaunda after nearly 27 years at the helm of the country. Kaunda's strained relations with the later president Frederick Chiluba reached a low point when Kaunda was arrested on December 25, 1997, and sent to a maximum security prison. Later, Kaunda was placed under house arrest. After losing his son to HIV and AIDS in the late 80s, Kaunda created the Kenneth Kaunda Children's of Africa Foundation, which paid for food, medical care, and the education for AIDS orphans, according to the U.S. Agency for International Development. Kaunda became the first African leader to publicly announce that AIDS had affected his family. In 2017, I accompanied Shaka Sali, the retired longtime host of Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa program, to Zambia and met the former president at his residence outside of Lusaka. Kaunda was an avid fan of Straight Talk Africa, a show he said he watched regularly over the years. The gracious Kaunda gave us a tour of his residence and treated us to his skills on the piano. President Kenneth Kaunda will be best remembered as a champion for African liberation in the struggle for independence. Paul Ndiho, VOA News, Washington.
The United States has a new federal holiday.
So throughout history, Juneteenth has been known by many names. Jubilee Day, Freedom Day, Liberation Day, Emancipation Day, and today, a national holiday.
Vice President Kamala Harris provided the opening remarks in the White House East Room and highlighted the day's historical importance.
Let us be clear about what happened on June 19th, 1865, the day we call Juneteenth. Because you see, that day was not the end of slavery in America. Yes, on that day, the enslaved people of Galveston, Texas, learned that they were free. But in fact, 2.5 years earlier, the Emancipation Proclamation ended slavery in the Confederacy. So think about that. For more than 2 years, the enslaved people of Texas were kept in servitude for more than 2 years. They were intentionally kept from their freedom.
President Joe Biden, in his remarks, called America's past with slavery its original sin and called June 19th a day of profound weight and power.
By making Juneteenth a federal holiday, all Americans can feel the power of this day and learn from our history and celebrate progress and grapple with the distance we've come, but the distance we have to travel, Jim. You know, I said a few weeks ago, marking the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre, great nations don't ignore their most painful moments. Great nations don't ignore their most painful moments. They don't ignore those moments in the past. They embrace them. Great nations don't walk away. We come to terms with the mistakes we made.
Closing out his remarks, Biden reflected on what it meant to him personally to sign the holiday into law.
In short, this day doesn't just celebrate the past. It calls for action today. I wish all Americans a happy Juneteenth. I'm certainly going to sign into law, making it a federal holiday. And I have to say to you, I've only been president for several months, but I think this will go down for me as one of the greatest honors I will have had as president.
Juneteenth joins 10 other federal holidays and is the first added since Martin Luther King Jr. Day became a holiday in 1983, although that holiday was not observed until 1986. The U.S. House of Representatives took up a measure on Thursday to repeal a two-decades-old bill giving U.S. presidents sweeping powers to conduct the war on terror. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson explains why U.S. lawmakers believe that the bill is long overdue for an update.
Nearly 20 years since the United States went to war in Iraq, the congressional authorization allowing President George W. Bush to topple Saddam Hussein is now one step closer to ending. Since the authorization, three U.S. presidents from both parties have interpreted that language to engage in a broad range of conflicts. Democratic Representative Barbara Lee.
To this day, our endless war continues, costing trillions of dollars and thousands of lives in a war that goes way beyond any scope that Congress conceived or intended.
Under the U.S. Constitution, only Congress has the authority to declare war. But in the wake of the September 11th attacks, lawmakers gave presidents broad powers to enter into conflict. That authorization for use of military force, or AUMF, ultimately weakens the U.S. military, one Iraq War veteran argues. Democratic Representative Ruben Gallego.
The longer this AUMF is on the books, the longer we in Congress are abandoning our own moral and constitutional duty to debate and to decide when to send American soldiers into harm's way.
President Trump used the 2002 AUMF to justify the 2020 airstrike killing Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, a decision that Republicans say proves its necessity. Republican Representative Michael McCaul.
I also share the desire to repeal the 2002 AUMF as well as the 2001 AUMF. But that must be a part of a serious process to provide clear, updated authorities against the terrorists who still plot to kill Americans at home and abroad.
The U.S. Senate is expected to vote on that resolution shortly, where the repeal has the support of Democratic leadership. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
The Iraq War has been over for nearly a decade. An authorization passed in 2002 is no longer necessary in 2021.
But it will face opposition from Republicans who argue the process has been rushed. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
The grave threats posed by ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist groups are as real as they've ever been. And repealing AUMFs without agreeing on a set of new authorities up front will only lead to more uncertainty about what we're going to do about them.
Earlier this week, the White House supported the repeal, but also called on lawmakers to pass a new framework that allows the United States to defend itself. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. As the United States and NATO pull their troops out of Afghanistan, civilian casualties have increased, especially among women and children. With the outlook bleak, experts are considering options to try to prevent catastrophe in the war-stricken country. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has that story.
With U.S. and NATO forces said to be out of Afghanistan this year, the future of the country is on a lot of people's minds, including U.S. President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Biden said Putin asked him about it at their summit in Geneva.
He asked us about Afghanistan. He said that he hopes that we're able to maintain some peace and security. And I said that has a lot to do with you. He indicated that he was prepared to, quote, help on Afghanistan. I won't go into detail now.
With civilian casualties almost 30% higher in Afghanistan than they were around this time last year, experts gathered remotely on Zoom for a forum held by the Center for Strategic International Studies entitled Preventing Catastrophe in Afghanistan. One of the speakers, Afghanistan's ambassador to the United Nations, Adela Raz, objected to the narrative suggested by the title.
I know we all are preparing or thinking of a worst-case scenario, but I must tell you, the catastrophe is not as magnified in Afghanistan as much as it is outside of Afghanistan. And if we look into it as a catastrophe, I think we right away question the type of investment we have made in the last 20 years and its effectiveness. So there is no catastrophe. I think it's a very difficult testing period for us.
Raz said U.S. and NATO investment in her country has paid off. She said Afghan national forces are now capable and at the forefront of fighting terrorism. But she stressed they need continued logistical and financial support so that the Taliban know they can never take over the country by force.
Yesterday's class was good, was it not?
Some lawmakers, including Representative Michael Waltz of Florida, still wish Biden would leave a small contingent of U.S. troops there.
To be candid, that we are, I fear, making a strategic mistake with a full withdrawal from Afghanistan. I've long supported keeping a small training capacity to continue to work with and train our Afghan national security partners and a counterterrorism capacity.
Biden says there is no military solution to the conflict in Afghanistan, but has pledged continued American support to the Afghan people. Experts say the U.S. must keep in mind how high the humanitarian and national security stakes are, and to make sure that Afghanistan does not face catastrophe after foreign forces leave. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The United Nations warns accelerating climate change is causing a dramatic intensification of global drought disasters. They are threatening agricultural production, the world's safe water supply, and other essential aspects of human development. Lisa Schlein reports the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction has launched a special report on drought for 2021.
UN researchers say drought has affected more people around the world in the past four decades than any other natural disaster. The UN report warns the impact of the climate-driven drought emergency on the lives and livelihoods of people across the planet will worsen in the coming years. The UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Disaster Risk Reduction, Mamie Mizutori, says drought has directly affected 1.5 billion people so far this century. She says most of the world will be living with water stress in the next few years as drought disasters grow. She says drought is a major factor in land degradation and is responsible for declining yields of major crops. She adds shifting rainfall patterns and variability pose a risk to the 70% of global agriculture that is rainfall dependent.
A warming planet threatens to multiply the number of people without access to safe water and sanitation, thereby seriously increasing the spread of diseases, the risk of displacement, and the potential even for conflict over scarce water resources.
While droughts always have been part of the human experience, the damage and costs resulting from them are seriously underestimated. The report estimates the global economic costs arriving from drought from 1998 to 2017 of at least $124 billion. The World Health Organization considers drought to be the most serious hazard to livestock and crops in nearly every part of the world. It says water scarcity impacts 40% of the world's population. WHO projects as many as 700 million people are at risk of being displaced by 2030 because of drought. Leading co-author of the report, Roger Pulwati, agrees the data contained within the report is grim, but does not see an apocalyptic picture ahead.
And I don't think that there is, in fact, this issue surrounding the collapse of civilizations called. We're not seeing truly an increase in the frequency of drought, but we are seeing that where they occur in the different regions in which they do exist, an increase in the intensification when they occur, and the rapid onset of drought.
Over the millennia, Pulwati notes people have found ways to adapt to risks from drought and other natural disasters. He says lessons learned from over 20 cases around the world, including the Horn of Africa and the Euphrates and Tigris River system in Western Asia, have been incorporated in the report. However, he says tried and true drought management measures taken in the past must be adapted to meet the challenges of today's changing nature of drought risk. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
International donors pledged tens of millions of dollars worth of emergency aid on Thursday to help prop up Lebanon's struggling army, a key institution for the country's stability that is lacking basics, including food. Lisa Bryan has more on the meeting that was hosted by France and Italy.
Thursday's virtual meeting had an unusual cause, not to offer humanitarian aid to Lebanon's struggling poor, but to its army, teetering under the fallout of the country's worst economic crisis in more than a century. A French government statement issued after the talks said international support for Lebanon's army aimed to meet human and basic maintenance needs and was no substitute for essential reforms the country needs. An army spokeswoman told VOA the aid worth tens of millions of dollars targeted areas like food, fuel, and medical supplies and would be released within weeks or months. Since 2019, the Lebanese pound has lost 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar. Added to that, the government plans to cut subsidies on key goods like fuel and food.
Simple soldiers who used to earn the equivalent of $1,000 a month, roughly, now earn the equivalent of $100, and because the prices have gone up dramatically.
Heiko Wiemann is Lebanon Project Director at the International Crisis Group Policy Institute.
Essentially, the soldiers are going hungry, and the budget that the army has to buy anything, need to buy spare parts, to buy whatever they need to for daily affairs. Those budgets have become completely meaningless.
For Lebanon and the donor community, the funding would prop up one of the few institutions remaining above the country's deep divisions. Army Chief Joseph Aoun, who visited Paris recently, said the military was forced to turn to its allies to survive.
L'armée en faillite.
University of Geneva International Relations Professor Hasni Abidi says for the international community, the implications of letting Lebanon's army collapse are too big. A failed army means a failed state, a population in deep trouble, and victory for Iran-backed Hezbollah, the military group dominating Lebanon's power structure. The army also secures Lebanon's border with Israel. Lebanon's economy began collapsing in 2019, after years of political corruption and mismanagement. French President Emmanuel Macron has visited the country several times and led international aid efforts, including this one. But he has also sharply criticized its political leaders for failing to carry out key reforms. The problem with Thursday's meeting, analysts say, is it offers only a stopgap solution.
But the alternative is that you say, okay, fine, let it all collapse and crash, and let it burn, if that's if that's what's the consequences. So to finally force these players to face the music, you know. But I mean, that is of course a big gamble. We have seen in the region what state collapse can mean.
Once split along sectarian lines during Lebanon's 15-year civil war, the army recovered to become a unifying force that is one of the most professional in the Middle East. The army's biggest foreign backer, the United States, has promised to increase its support this year. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The United Nations General Assembly will gather on Friday to discuss and possibly vote on a resolution about the current situation in Myanmar. The measure would call for a stop of arms flow, for the military junta to respect last November's election, and release political detainees, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Myanmar's UN ambassador asked members not to support the military directly or indirectly, intentionally or unintentionally. Ambassador Jaw Mo Tun does not speak for the country's military, but rather the country's civilian leadership. He told Reuters news agency, quote, "It is very important to show their strong support towards the people of Myanmar in our efforts to restore democracy, bring the state power back to the people, and build a federal democratic union." End quote. In addition, the U.S. State Department says that it has not been granted consular access to detained American journalist Danny Fenster. A second American journalist, Nathan Mong, was recently released from Myanmar and has arrived back in the United States. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Iranians go to the polls on Friday to choose a new president. Critics say that the election is far from being free or fair, and as Henry Ridgewell reports, public discontent could lead to a low voter turnout.
Iran's economy has been shrinking for most of the last 3 years, largely because of sanctions imposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump after he withdrew the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018, accusing Tehran of destabilizing the region, which Tehran denies. Sanam Vakil is from the London-based policy institute Chatham House.
These sanctions have impacted Iran's economy in a significant way, but above all, deeply impacted ordinary Iranians that are suffering from rising prices and a declining currency. Against this backdrop, also, of course, Iran has weathered COVID-19. It has the highest death rate in the Middle East.
Against that backdrop, Iranians go to the polls Friday to choose a successor to President Hassan Rouhani. Only four candidates remain after three pulled out Wednesday, all of them approved and vetted by the Iranian regime's Guardian Council. Three are hardline conservatives. Just one is a reformist. Ben Taleblu is from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington.
The regime itself, in every iteration of quote-unquote election since 2009, has been gutting the left flank of its political system, further contracting the boundaries for acceptable space, and with Khamenei at the helm, dragging the system further to the hard right.
Iran has been rocked by a series of events that have shaped the electoral landscape. The U.S. targeted killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in January 2020 prompted widespread public fury. Days later, Iranian forces accidentally shot down a Ukrainian airline passenger jet, triggering anti-government protests. Again, Sanam Vakil.
So there have been, you know, a cycle of interconnected events that have dampened popular sentiment. And in November 2019, protests over rising oil prices were also brutally repressed. So ordinary Iranians are not particularly inclined to vote.
The favorite to win is 60-year-old Ibrahim Raisi, the head of Iran's judiciary. His past involvement in human rights abuses would make him a problematic president for the West, say analysts. Again, Benam Ben Taleblu.
He's unfortunately most famous for his despicable oversight of what is called a so-called death commission in the late 1980s that carried out their the murder edict from Ayatollah Khomeini that killed upwards of 5,000 political prisoners in Tehran.
Iran has significantly ramped up its nuclear enrichment and is believed to be just months away from creating enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon. The Biden administration is considering rejoining the 2015 nuclear deal, but only if Iran halts enrichment. Iran says the U.S. must first suspend sanctions. Talks in Vienna are ongoing. Again, Sanam Vakil.
The lifting of sanctions would be a huge boon that could have a trickle-down effect that would be hugely meaningful for ordinary people. That said, I think Iranians today are less invested in the Iran nuclear agreement and less trustful of the United States or European countries.
All Iran's presidential candidates support negotiations to revive the nuclear deal. Again, Sanam Vakil.
There is expectation that with the election completed, perhaps there will be more confidence on the Iranian side in Vienna to get the deal done.
With Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei in his 80s, the handover of power to his successor is expected in the coming years, adding further complexity to the challenges facing Iran's next president. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And finally, parts of the United States are being invaded by a mass brood of cicadas that emerges from the ground once every 17 years. For most people, the noisy insects are a nuisance, but for others, they're a meal. Irfan Ihsan rounds us out.
If you live in the Washington, D.C. area, there's been a constant high-pitched buzz in the air for weeks now. It's caused by cicadas, and these particular cicadas show up around every 17 years to reproduce. For many, their noise and discarded shells are a nuisance. But to Chef Seng Longlot, owner and chef at the Laotian restaurant Tip Cow, they are a welcome sight.
So we want to make sure it's clean, we want to make sure it's cooked, so we want to make sure it's safe. You have to do at least three, four times, right? Depends on how much dirt.
You've heard of farm to table. Well, during cicada season, Chef Seng cooks up dishes from tree to table.
So we start harvesting a lot of it, and I've been posting photos of it, sharing on social media. It gets a lot of customer attention, the people who are not our customer, people our customer. So we do some sort of survey, like who would want to try it. So most people are like, respond with like the younger people. So they are more like adventurers, and they want to try it. They want to see how it tastes like.
Chef Seng has prepared three different types of cicada-based dishes for us to try today. Jiao Jiak Jian, fried cicadas smashed with roasted garlic, ginger, onion, fish sauce, and fresh lime juice.
Go and put in the oil. We're
going to
need a little bit more oil
because
we're
going to
fry them.
Kuah Jiak Jian, fried cicadas with peanut, lime leaves, tamarind, salt, and garlic. And a salad called Lap Jiak Jian, which is boiled cicadas, fish sauce, lime juice, toasted rice powder, and herbs.
All right, this is Lap Cicada.
These dishes are not included on the restaurant's main menu and are available for takeout only.
So when our guests call, you know, or they order online, it will be like just say Jiak Jian. So that's kind of like a secret. So they will come and pick up to go only.
In many countries in the world, insects are a regular source of food, but not in much of the West.
You know, at a very young age, I remember like my aunts, uncles, my parents, they would like go out and like harvest all these cicadas. It's been perceived in America that these, you know, cicadas are bugs or considered as disgusting, but in other cultures, it's considered as a delicacy.
We ask a first-time cicada eater to give us a review.
Rasanya enak, gurih.
It tastes good, savory. The texture is crunchy, maybe like shrimp. Very delicious.
Nutritionists and environmentalists alike have long promoted insects as a more sustainable source of protein than a farm-raised cattle. But here in the U.S., having cicadas for dinner is only for the most daring of eaters. From Washington, D.C., Irfan Ihsan, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day you can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.